know of when structural engineers are called to assess the integrity of a home, that the people that live in that home will either have good news or incredibly bad news, depending on what the engineer has to say. And maybe you haven't experienced this, but chances are, with all of the home renovation TV series that have been out for years now, that you watch in anticipation of what's going to be said in this phase of the construction or renovation process. Because if they get bad news, that's going to completely destroy or take off track the plans that the people have in their home. And it's the same way when we see this assessment that the Apostle Paul presents to Timothy here, the way that he explains doctrine and the gospel and the law of God altogether. We could say that this passage is somewhat of a survey of the structural integrity or the soundness of God's people. What's fascinating about this book of the Bible, 1 Timothy, is that it comes along a long list of books that are attributed to the Apostle Paul, but most importantly, a long list of books that are written to the Ephesian church. You think about the history, like we've read in the book of Acts, where the church in Ephesus is referenced again and again. Paul's final warning to the Ephesians of his departure that these wolves, these false teachers, are going to come up and try to snuff out what it is that he's been laboring to teach to them for all of this time. Or you think about his letter to the Ephesian church, this bastion of Christian doctrine that Paul presents to the Ephesians so they would have a right understanding of the gospel, a right understanding of what it means to believe in this Jesus Christ who has saved them, who is all divine. And at the same time, Paul gives somewhat of a recipe for the Christian life and the ends of the book of Ephesians. But that's not the end of the story. We could fast forward all the way to 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, which is in all likelihood written to the Christians in Ephesus, in the surrounding area. Or you could skip all the way to the book of Revelation, where Jesus himself speaks to the Ephesian church as one of the seven churches. And then here in 1st and 2nd Timothy, Paul addresses Timothy in Ephesus of what's going on. If there ever was a favorite church, you might say that it was the Ephesians, because they had the Apostle John, the Apostle Paul, and even Jesus Christ himself writing explicitly to them. And it's fascinating to see all of the things that they seem to wrestle with. And yet at the same time, once we get to the final verdict of the Ephesian church, Jesus says to them, "I commend you for your doctrine, but your love has grown cold." And he gives that familiar message to repent, which we spoke of very briefly this morning. But here, Paul is addressing Timothy before that final verdict comes. And in the first seven verses of this book, before we get to our passage, Paul is mentioning these false teachers that have crept up in some ways to sour the Christian message. And the fascinating way that they did this was by their conduct. And so you have this play on doctrine and conduct and what the law is and what the gospel is. And so what Paul is doing here in verses 8 through 11 is he's introducing his first bit of correction to these false teachers. He's instructing Timothy of what should be going on when we're laboring to understand doctrine and understand doctrine in light of the gospel. So we might say it this way, that what Paul is teaching Timothy and what he's teaching us this evening is that the gospel is a matter of holiness, not lawlessness. And we'll see that first and foremost in verse 8, where Paul speaks to us about how to use the law. Now we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully. Imagine if you had an appointment with a psychiatrist. You're told to sit down, and they're doing this assessment of the way that you think. And they say, "Tell me what comes to mind when you hear the phrase, the law of God." What would you say if you were asked to describe how you feel about the law of God? What is the law of God? Would you speak of it in sentimental terms? Would you speak of it in terrifying terms? Would you associate it, since it's part of the Old Testament, that it's therefore old and outdated? It's eclipsed by the gospel. Would you say that the law is bad because we're all about modernizing things? We're all about progressing things. How would you associate the law of God in your mind? It's interesting that we even have to speak about the law by way of a defense. Paul says we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully. It's interesting because we do live in an era of Christianity that is not so much unlike the past, but we might not understand the kind of controversies that have happened in the past, this being one prime example, that the law seems to have taken a negative connotation among people who call themselves Christians. Even depending on what denomination you belong to, you will get a totally different sentiment about whether the law is good or not in its ultimate sense. We have to wrestle with this a little bit, but it's important at least to give a brief defense of the law in a positive light. Why it is that Paul would say that the law is good, especially in the same conversation where he speaks of the gospel. Can you say that the law is good in comparison to the good news? And why are they distinct if the law itself is good? We might think about the preface to the Ten Commandments. What is the context of which God gives Israel the Ten Commandments? What is the context of which God gives them the law? Well, it's a gracious context. It's a gift, we might even say. The law is a gift from God, that God gives them this identifier of what the law is by virtue of him saving them. Before God gives the Ten Commandments, he rehearses what he has just done for them. I am the Lord your God that has led you out of Egypt, that is leading you to the promised land, that has promised to be your God. Therefore, this is how you are to live as my people. It's a positive connotation because the whole idea of God rescuing them was an act of grace. It wasn't a deserved thing. And God gives this to them not as a punishment, not as a negative thing to make them fall flat on their face necessarily, but as a gift to reflect who he is and who they are to be. That's all well and good, but that's just the initial story. What do we say about the law after Israel proves again and again that they fail? Well, I can't help but think of the longest chapter in the entire Bible. What is it? It's a love song about the law, Psalm 119. The longest chapter in the Bible celebrating the goodness and the glory of the law of God. But that's the Old Testament. What about the New Testament? Well, of course, we have here that Paul says that the law is good. But elsewhere, we have descriptors of the law as holy, as spiritual, as good, as delightful. So this idea of the law being bad is really one that we need to get out of our vocabulary. We'll qualify this in just a minute, but it is important to realize that Paul begins by speaking of these lawless false teachers, not by condemning the law itself, but by condemning their actions, their intent, their hearts. But he wants to make sure we understand this law is good. Now here's the qualifier, if one uses it lawfully. When we understand how one uses the law, this is where the debate comes in. This is where you figure out whether you align with what Lutherans believe, or you align with what non-denominational churches believe, or you align with what Presbyterians believe, or you're somewhere in the middle of all that. Well, I think Calvin really gives a helpful understanding of what it means to use the law lawfully. And this would be a classic Presbyterian understanding that the law has a threefold use. Using the law lawfully means understanding the intent of the law. And just very briefly, I'd like to just illustrate these. That the law, first and foremost, is like a mirror. The law shows us who we are. When we think about the negativity associated with the law, it is not what the law says, but it's what the law shows. What does the law show about us? What does the law demonstrate as far as who we are? We could also say that the law is a mirror in another sense, in that it reflects who God is. What the law has to say about its code of conduct, what it has to say about the holiness that's portrayed, is meant to be a reflection of who God is. It shows us what he is like. It shows us in real nitty-gritty terms how to understand his holiness, how to understand his perfection. But most importantly, what this does is it shows us the bad news. It is a mirror in that it shows us that God is holy and we are not. It shows us that God is holy and he requires of us that we be holy, and yet we see again and again that we fail. We see that we are unholy. The second way in which the law works, which it can be used, is as a restrainer. We might say it this way, that the law is somewhat of a common grace. The normal illustration is mentioned that if you have a speed limit that says 45, you're probably going to be willing to go 60. But you're probably not going to go 80 or 90 or 100. It restrains in some ways, because if there were no speed limit signs whatsoever, you would have the Autobahn on every single road that there is. But the law works in a way not to stop us from sinning, but to restrain us from being as bad as we would otherwise be. We understand this as speaking of God's common grace for us. That God, although we as Presbyterians speak of total depravity, that we are depraved in every aspect of who we are, that God restrains us from being as depraved as we otherwise would be in every aspect. Because God has a restraining hand. He keeps things from being as evil, as unholy as they otherwise would be. But yet again, just as that first use, what this is meant to do as God gives the law to Israel, as God gives it to us, it's meant to show us in both senses of our inability in and of ourselves. It is preparatory. It is a teacher. It is meant to drive us to something else. It's to drive us to the very holiness which it communicates, but which it shows again and again that we don't possess ourselves. And this is really the best way that we can understand, especially in this context, using the law lawfully as Christians. There is a huge debate, especially in this one, because almost every denomination would probably agree with the first two things I said, but this is where it gets tricky, because you have to make sure that what we're talking about here is, while we're Christians, and now we can use the law, that we're not saying we use the law in order to stay saved, or we use the law in order to be saved. But yet at the same time, we have to think about what it is that the law is. It is a guide to which it reveals to us God in his wisdom. It gives us a greater taste for obedience and a greater distaste for sin. As we confess that as we're saved, and God is renewing that image of God in us day in and day out, he calls us to be holy as he is holy. And we still look at that moral law of God expressed in the Ten Commandments as a clear picture of what holiness looks like. It is not as if we say now that we're Christians, it's okay to murder each other. It's now okay to commit adultery because we don't have to follow the law. Right? There's a moral obligation that continues even for Christians to follow the law. And this is what Paul is getting at, because what he does now, as he turns to start explaining things here, is he rehearses, in some ways, the Ten Commandments. Verse 9 through most of verse 10. Let me just read that again. Think of these in terms of the Ten Commandments. There's not a one-to-one correlation here, but there's a loose following of the Ten Commandments. Understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who strike their fathers and mothers, for murderers, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. Paul now moves to show us what it looks like, first and foremost, how to use the law in verse 8. But now in 9 and 10, what he does is demonstrate what we might call our sandcastles of sin. This is fascinating to me. When you go to the beach and you see these sandcastles that are built, maybe it's a competition. I've stumbled into a sandcastle competition one time here in Jacksonville, and I have to say I couldn't believe the kind of things that people can do with sand. But what's fascinating to me is that these sandcastles are typically not built as soon as your feet hit the sand. Where are they normally built? As close to the edge as you can possibly get. We have to find where that dividing line is. We want to get as close as we possibly can to it. Normally, families on vacation, you have little ones that want to build sandcastles. The advice of the parents is don't build it over there because the tide's going to come in and wash it away. So they build it a little bit further back, and then lo and behold, the tide evidently still comes and washes it away, and the sandcastle is gone. But what we see here is this idea of pushing the boundaries. Paul, on purpose, uses more of the emphatic ways to describe lawlessness here. In some ways, he follows the Ten Commandments, but you see in a few spots that he speaks of the more extreme way to commit these particular sins, these extreme things that go against the law. And what Paul is trying to do here is he's trying to help us understand in all shapes and fashions this idea that the Christian is meant to be sound. You see that at the very end of verse 10. Liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. That word sound speaks of healthiness. It speaks of the health of the body. And when we think about that earlier analogy of what that structural engineer is doing, he's coming in to assess the structural integrity or the soundness of the building. Does the integrity of the building work, or is it completely out of whack? We might think that we have buildings that are great in integrity. We might want to build our family life. We might want to do a whole bunch of things in the house and use the home as a wonderful place to make memories. And then you find out that all of the roof rafters are messed up. The whole thing could come collapsing down on top of you. Or if you're built up under a crawl space, that all of the supports are rotted out and at any minute could just fall down. That drastically changes what your plans were for that home. And in the same manner, what this law does is it shows these structural integrity markers for us in a way that shows whether we are indeed healthy or not. It's interesting the way that Paul communicates this to us, because he says that the law is laid down for these kinds of people. Using the law lawfully, in one sense, is understanding who we were. But using the law in another sense is understanding why it was needed. Paul is rehearsing why the law was needed and why it is a good thing, because what it does is it calls out lawlessness, disobedience, ungodliness, unholiness, profane, sexually immoral, murderers, on and on we can go. This is a structural assessment of the people, we could say. When we look at the very end of verse 10, whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine in accordance with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God, we have a surprising twist, we might say. The beginning of this paragraph, he's talking about the law, and then he speaks of the way we understand what it means to break these moral laws. What does it mean to break the commandment to murder? It means to be a murderer. What does it mean to break the commandment of do not commit adultery? It means to be sexually immoral. So he's showing the negative sense of these things, but then he explains those as anything else contrary to sound doctrine in accordance with the gospel. So you have in this paragraph a bookend of the law and the gospel, and an explanation of the law that weaves them together. Contrary to sound doctrine, the structural integrity doesn't only refer to the law, it refers to the gospel. And again, that may be a surprising twist, because we tend to think about the commands as something that gets us to the gospel, because we're unholy people. But then you get to the gospel, and then Paul says, all these things reflect that. So you have a connection point being made here, that our gospel practice is analogous to being lawful people. You think about the very simple adage that sin is lawlessness. A simple descriptor of what sin is, as lawlessness. So we think of what it means to be lawful, what it means to keep the laws, the opposite of sin. It's holiness. And the gospel speaks of holiness, the perfect holiness of Christ purchased for us, earned for us. And yet, the same holiness that God is in real time working in us as he renews us after the image of Christ, the holiness that we're told without which we cannot see God, the holiness that we're called to mimic, as God says, to be holy, even as I am holy, both to the Israelites in Exodus, but also Peter picks up on that and says it to the New Testament church, this idea of holiness as a counterpart to lawlessness. So this idea really drives us to an interesting way to think about the law, not as a contrast to the gospel, but something that supports what the gospel is saying, not only about what Jesus has done, but who we are to be in light of that. This idea is reflected in these, loosely speaking, Ten Commandments that Paul is rehearsing here in the negative, in God's glory. I love the phrase here, in accordance with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God. Depending on what translation you have, it might read, the glorious gospel of the blessed God. The idea is that God's glory, the blessedness of God, is directly tied to the gospel itself. The gospel reveals something about who God is. We might want to ask the question, what is the difference between the gospel and the law? One reveals the glory and blessedness of God. The other reveals the sin and misery of man. Which one is which? It's a trick question because they both do both of those things. The law reflects the glory of God. The law demonstrates who he is and his holiness. It also demonstrates the sin and misery of man. And yet the gospel reflects the glory and blessedness of God and also the sin and misery of man. Why is the good news good news? Because we need it because of our sin and misery, because of who God is. And it's qualified in that sense in accordance with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God. Now, it's very helpful for us to understand the connection that Paul makes because oftentimes the conversations come and some of the issues of Christian ethics that are asked, well, how do we know what things have been terminated in the Old Testament? Probably the most popular thing to look at is the idea of sexuality. What is just something that God had a problem with in the Old Testament and now suddenly the New Testament he doesn't because it's all about love and grace? Well, think of this example especially, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality. Those things are tied to whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine in accordance with the gospel of the glory of the blessed God. The reason that we say this moral law, the Ten Commandments, is still binding on us today, one of several reasons, is because it reflects the moral character of God. God cannot change. As I said earlier, it is not suddenly okay for us to commit murder. It is not suddenly okay for us to steal because these things speak of who he is in his holiness. And along with that means that as long as God is who he is, these commandments won't change. But who he is also reflected in the gospel, which means the only way that these things could change is if the gospel changes. So it's an important way for us to connect the dots there because we can be attacked all the time by people that want to say that we're living in the past or want to say that the things that we care about, the things that we say are matters of everybody's free choice versus what the Bible actually says. We want to be quick to realize that there's an argument to be made that these things are not issues that are up for debate. These things are tied to the character of God himself. And we see that here as a way for us to understand why it is that we would land where we do and not the way of so many other denominations, not the way of the culture. Our ethics are informed by God who does not change. And therefore, we see that these things connect to the gospel as well as the law. So what does this mean for us? What's the big idea that Paul's doing? Is Paul just simply trying to help Timothy spin his wheels to be a sharper pastor? Is he trying to divide fine line after fine line to where suddenly you're left with just this huge mass of confusion and we don't understand what to even do with this anymore? Have we gotten into a side tangent? Well, the big idea, I think, really comes from later on in this book. You don't have to turn there, but 1 Timothy 6:3. Paul helps us understand what this idea of soundness is. If anyone teaches a different doctrine and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that accords with godliness. The big idea here is not how much of the law we can keep on keeping or how much of the gospel we can keep on believing in and of itself. The big idea is godliness. The reason why these false teachers were false teachers is not only because of the things they were teaching. From all intents and purposes, it seems like what they were teaching was, generally speaking, decent enough. There's not glaring issues of ignoring the divinity of Christ like we see in a book like 1 John. The big problem is the conduct of these teachers. The big problem is how they lived. Paul doesn't want Timothy to follow after their steps because they're living in a way that is out of accord with the gospel. And the way that Paul shows what is in accord with the gospel is by going to the law. You see a way that Paul is calling us to use the law in light of the gospel, not as a way to earn our salvation, but as a way to grow in godliness, as a way to reflect who God is, as a way to continually rely on the Spirit, because we need the Spirit for this. But yet, these are ways that we can see whether we're in step with the culture or if we're in contrast to the culture. And the way we see that is in these simple, though not exhaustive, list of things that Paul shows what is contrary to the gospel. Do you want to know if you really believe the gospel? Here are the things that are contrary to it. Here are the characterizations that are contrary to the gospel. This is how you can know if you're not fully trusting in the gospel. Because if we do, there should be an outcome, though not perfect, an outcome that demonstrates that we are alive in Christ, that we are growing in our grace and knowledge of him, that he is renewing us day in and day out after the image of Christ. And that is the great news that Paul has here. He begins the letter in this way to start unpacking the glory of the gospel. Obviously, we don't have time to go through the whole book, but I highly recommend, especially if you haven't spent time in 1 Timothy, to read the rest of this letter to see how this really serves as a segue for the rest of what Paul says. But the big idea is that we understand that the gospel is not a license to lawlessness. It's not a free pass for us to live however we choose. It is a call to godliness because it reflects who God is and what he has done in our lives. So my prayer is that we would live in that way and that we would trust God to renew us day in and day out, that we might use the law to run to Christ, and we might use it to grow as we are being taught by Christ himself. Let's pray.